Part the Reckoning. Chapter Deadline 42. My mother died when I was 21, and she was 42, but I didn't find out on that day or even that week. My grandmother called a couple of months later, called casually in the middle of the day the way she always called, to ask how things were, and without waiting for an answer, report her own. Somewhere between complaints about the weather and market prices, she said, "Your mother died." And then in the same voice, without a pause, without a breath, began recounting the details, how the organs had decomposed, how she drank until the end, how they found her. It was the same voice, even businesslike, impenetrable. Not a scream, not a whisper, just a fact delivered like a weather forecast. Rain tomorrow, your mother's dead, potatoes got more expensive. My grandmother didn't know any other way. Her own grief, if she had any, she packaged in the same tone, even businesslike, impenetrable. 40-year-old me does the same, casually mentions to friends that she tried to drown herself, tried because unsuccessfully, while writing the first chapter of this book. They don't even notice such details. I stood holding the receiver, listening to her describe the organ decomposition of the daughter she had once cursed. And as she spoke, what rose inside me was not grief. What rose was a memory. My grandmother cursed people. She told me about it in childhood, and in the same casual tone, cursed a person and he died the same day. And then she cursed my mother. "You'll die under a fence." And Uncle Oleg. And me. And now my mother really had died. Oleg was already dead too by that point, beaten to death while drunk, just as my grandmother had predicted, and I, standing with the receiver, thought not about my mother. A thought crept in. She cursed me too, so it will happen to me too, and I will die. The child believed at 8. The adult didn't stop believing. The number 42, the age at which my mother died, settled inside as a deadline. Not a metaphor, not a fear, a deadline. As if life has a specific expiration date, and that date has already been set. And bargaining is pointless. The fear became a prophecy, and the prophecy became a fact that the body believed long before the head could object. I didn't scream when my grandmother hung up, didn't cry. My hand with the receiver dropped. Inside, silence, like after an explosion. Emptiness. The body did what it did best, shut down. The same mechanism that switched on at 6 months when mother wasn't there, the same one that fired when grandmother hit, the same one that saved me on my knees in the corner. The body doesn't fully shut down. It memorizes what the head refuses to accept. That night I didn't sleep, or the next, or after. Insomnia came not as a symptom, but as a new state. Permanent, ambient, inescapable. As if somewhere inside, the sentry who had stood guard all his life received an order that night. No more sleeping, no more relaxing. Mother is dead. The danger has become final. The curse works. You cannot close your eyes. The number 42 stopped being superstition. Mother died, and the curse became fact. The clock is ticking. Then the bleeding started. Heavy, frightening. The kind I nearly died from. Before that, they had never happened. Never. There were bladder problems. There was anxiety. There was a tense body that hadn't relaxed since birth. But bleeding that doesn't stop after 2 weeks had never happened. Usually it was always 8 days. And now, it wouldn't stop. It came after my mother's death as if the body had decided, since the curse is real, let's start dying right now. My grandmother called in March. By June, it hit me so hard I couldn't eat. Couldn't get up, couldn't do anything. I just lay there. And the depression was not sadness, but a disconnection from life, as if someone pulled the battery out of me and forgot to put it back. For the first time in my life, I was put on antidepressants. I was 21, swallowing pills without understanding what exactly they were treating. I didn't connect anything with anything. The insomnia with the phone call, the bleeding with her death, the depression with the fact that mother would never come. I treated symptoms without asking why. The body knew, the head didn't. And this gap lasted 20 years. Only at 40, when I began dismantling myself piece by piece, not through books, but through the body, through what surfaced on its own, did I suddenly see the obvious, as if someone turned on the light in a room where I'd been groping in the dark for 20 years. All the health problems began after my mother's death. The body was still mourning her, in the only language it had. Pain. But since I had suppressed feelings, shut off the heart back in childhood, only the body hurt. The head didn't get the message. And for 20 years, I thought I was simply ill, that I had weak health, that these things happen. Because connecting your pain with a loss means admitting the loss existed, and admitting the loss means admitting there was something to lose. That my mother, despite everything she did and didn't do, still existed inside me as hope. A small, foolish, childish hope that someday she'd come back, become different, look at me and say, "I'm sorry, I'm here. Mother didn't come back." And with that phrase inside me died not only hope, the part of the child that was still waiting died. Quietly, without drama, simply stopped waiting, and in its place remained a formula that then ran my entire life. All my efforts are for nothing. Nothing will change. No one will come. Everything will always be bad. And if it suddenly gets good, wait, because happiness always has a price. Someone will suffer. Someone will die. It's always been that way. Chapter Alive. My first love, Maxim. I fell in love with him at first sight. He was secretive, closed off, one of those people who don't let anyone pass the hallway. But I was Vera, the girl people trust. I could earn trust as naturally as breathing, because I'd been learning it my whole life, reading people, adjusting, guessing what a person needs and giving it before they ask. With grandmother, this was a matter of survival. With Maxime, it became, for the first time, something resembling life. He spoke my language, gifts and touch, immediately. Without translation, without a dictionary, without instructions. Beside him, I felt something unfamiliar. Spontaneity, contact, the feeling that you can simply be rather than perform a function. Those were my best years. Not because I healed or something inside got fixed, but because for the first time in my life, there was a space where you didn't have to survive every minute. University work, Kaspersky, all of it spun around. But the center was him. Or more precisely, what I felt beside him, that I am a woman who is desired. But even in this, there was something I didn't see at the time. I tried to attach myself to his family, to be convenient, perfect, the one they'd accept. Beside Maxime, I felt defective, because he had a family, a normal one, with a mother who waited for dinner, with a father. With conversations at the table, with that domestic, invisible warmth that other people get by default. And I, never. His mother's name was Nadezhda Vasilyevna. Nadezhda, like my grandmother. I later, already in therapy, realized this coincidence and gasped. I'd been searching for a mother my whole life, in grandmother, in other families, in women who were nearby, and found another Nadezhda. I loved her, gave gifts, did everything to become one of them. So they'd accept me, so this family would become mine, because I didn't have my own and never would. When Maxim and I broke up, I asked his permission to keep seeing his parents, because by calling them Mom and Dad, without adding Maxim's, I created the feeling that I too have parents, an orphan who found a family through a man, and didn't want to lose the family even after losing the man. And then the relationship I considered my best years became something else. Not immediately. Slowly, like water erodes stone. Maxime didn't earn. Made $18,000, most of which went to his lunches and gas. I paid for the apartment, food, groceries. I got a job at Kaspersky in a high salary, high demand position. Commuted to the city. Exhausted myself to near death, stressed. He saw this. Flatly refused to move to the city. Didn't help around the house. I stayed silent and endured. Because silence and endurance were what I did best. because with grandmother, staying silent and enduring was a matter of survival. And with a man, it seemed to me this was called love and patience inspire. I'd later call this my mistake number one. I took out a car loan because I had a high salary and he didn't. I took on what he should have done and called it investing in the future. I later call this mistake number two. I did with Maxime the same thing I did with grandmother in childhood, earned the right to be nearby. Only with grandmother, the currency was A's and obedience, and with Maxime, money and patience. Same formula. If I'm useful enough, convenient enough, patient enough, they won't throw me out. If I pay for the apartment and take out a loan, he'll see how hard I'm trying and love me for real. I didn't know then that this isn't love. This is servicing. And the difference between them is enormous. He beautifully described how great our life would be. And I believed. Because in my world, if a person promises, they deliver. I always delivered. If you want something, you fight to the last. And I thought everyone was like that. That if Maxime promises, he's making the effort. Just need to wait. Need to endure a little more. Stay silent a little more. Pay a little more. And then came the feeling I described in a letter to him years later. I was simply used. It was convenient with me. Words and actions diverged all this time. He only promised but did nothing. And the most painful. I made a mistake in my choice. I don't understand people. The girl who'd been reading grandmother by the sound of footsteps since age six didn't see that the man beside her took and didn't give back. But even in this disappointment lived an untruth, because alongside the feeling of I was used lived another. Beside him, I was myself for the first time. Beside him, I felt contact, spontaneity, life. And these two truths, he used me and beside him I was alive, couldn't coexist inside. So I chose one, the one that caused less pain. He's bad, I made a mistake, must forget. And then the relationship became a habit, or so it seemed to me. It got uninteresting. A feeling appeared that I hadn't tried everything I should have tried. That life is bigger than this relationship. This is a normal stage of intimacy that I simply didn't know how to recognize. Intimacy without drama felt like emptiness. Calm felt like absence of life. If it doesn't hurt, nothing is happening. A body accustomed to anxiety didn't recognize peace. Mistook it for boredom. And the accumulated disappointment, silent, unnamed, packaged in patience, gave one more argument. Leave. You deserve better. You've invested so much and got no return. Leave. Vici and I started dating, and I broke up with Maxime. Left. Voluntarily. On my own feet. From the only relationship where I felt alive and desired. Left because I didn't believe good things could last. Somewhere very deep, deeper than thoughts, lived a belief. If things are good now, bad is coming soon. Better to leave yourself than wait to be left. Grandmother said, don't like it, leave. And I left. Only this time, not from a home, but from love. Then I suffered for 7 years. Not beautifully, not poetically. Dully, monotonously, like a toothache that doesn't pass and you can't get used to. 7 years I regretted leaving. That I didn't try everything before going. That I didn't appreciate. That I didn't see what I had. That I chose Vitya. Not for love, but by calculation, by strategy, by the habit of surviving rather than living. Under ketamine, much later, Maxime surfaced on his own. Without invitation, I saw the contact we had, the spontaneity, the feeling of being a woman, and understood what exactly I'd been missing all those years with Vitya, romance, attention, and the possibility of being myself. That I didn't need to be useful to be needed. Maxime gave me this, and I didn't see it, because I didn't know this was even possible. Because I grew up in a house where love had to be earned, and when it came for free, I didn't believe it. Therapist Tatiana later said something I couldn't breathe after for a long time. She said, you don't recognize your kind feelings for him. You insist on indifference, roll out a list of grievances, and convince yourself he was just a training ground. You do this because he's dangerous. He can leave you. And I understood. I denied love for Maxime for exactly the same reason I denied everything good in my life. If you admit you love, you become vulnerable. If vulnerable, you'll lose. If you lose, the pain will be unbearable. Better not to admit. Better to call it habit. Better to compile a list of mistakes, his and mine, and hide love behind the bookkeeping of grievances. This was the same girl who at 7 walked from her mother's house to the bus stop at night and waited for mother to turn around. Mother didn't turn around, and the girl decided, I'll leave first, always, from any relationship, from any closeness, from any place where I feel good, because if I stay and wait, no one will run after me. I didn't go back to Maxime, and he didn't run after me, and the 7 years of pain afterward weren't about him. They were about everything I'd allowed myself to feel beside him and then took away from myself. Maxime. First love. First space where you could simply be. I write about him and feel the body remembering warmth. Not pain. Warmth. Which means it existed. Which means I could feel it. Which means not everything was disconnected. Chapter Mexico. At Kaspersky, I worked with Victor, but back then he was just a colleague, one of those programmers you see in the hallway and greet on autopilot. I was sent to an international security conference because I won a contest, an internal competition for the best presentation. I prepared for it the way I prepared for everything in life, thoroughly, obsessively, to the point of burnout, as if what depended on it wasn't a presentation, but my right to exist. Because in my inner world, it did. Vitya also got a trip to that conference, as a reward for being a great programmer. But his plane froze, the flight was canceled, and he was stranded. I helped him rebook the tickets. The rebooking became the reason Vitya ended up in the same hotel as me. The conference ended, everyone left, and we stayed. In one hotel, in Mexico, in that strange space between colleagues and something else, where you can still pretend nothing is happening. But something was happening. I seduced him out of boredom. That's what I later wrote in a letter to him 10 years later, when I was trying to be honest. Out of boredom. But boredom was a lie. Not out of boredom. Out of hunger. That same emotional hunger that had lived in me since infancy, which I confuse now with love, now with boredom, now with a desire for something new. Hunger for contact. My perfectionist stood behind the scenes of every presentation. 20 rehearsals, a perfect slide, sterile confidence. Inside, the same terror as before grandmother's diary check. Vitya was my prop for the presentation at that conference. I spoke. And won. Best Speaker Award. International Security Conference. A hall full of people. Applause and award. From the outside, it looked like triumph. My grandmother probably would have said nothing, like back then with the diary, would have looked and gone to make soup. But inside, I was waiting for that applause the way I'd waited for grandmother's good job all through childhood. I got it. From strangers, from the audience, not from her. And that evening, Vitya and I sat in a bar, and I wasn't thinking about the award. I was thinking that next to me was a person who made me feel good. Not because I was useful to him, but just because. And at the same time, I was thinking about Maxime, about how everything with him had become a habit, that I was bored with him, that I hadn't tried everything I should have tried. All those thoughts that would later turn into 7 years of regret seemed at the time like a sober assessment. I didn't understand yet that this wasn't sobriety. It was my way of fleeing intimacy before intimacy could cause pain. We were left in the hotel alone. But I didn't want to cheat on Maxime. I told Vitya, no. Not because I was a saint. And not because I loved Maxime that much in that moment. I did. But I'd already gotten used to that love. And what you're used to doesn't feel like love. I said no because I had rules. Rigid, iron, unbending rules I'd set for myself back in childhood when the only way not to get lost in chaos was to hold on to structure. Don't cheat. That was structure. Don't lie. Structure. Finish what you start. structure, like grandmother's corset, only my own, voluntary, internal. If I don't break the rules, I'm safe. Vicha accepted. We went our separate ways, and I was sure that was the end of it. By then, everything with Maxime had become a habit, or so it seemed. I knew in advance what he'd say, how he'd look, how he'd turn in bed. He was no longer a mystery, and in my world without mystery, there was nothing to breathe. I was uninterested. The relationship had reached the point that normal people probably call stability. But I didn't know that stability is normal. For me, stability felt like a stop. As if life had ended, and everyone had just forgotten to announce it. A brain that grew up in anxiety doesn't recognize peace. 5 out of 10 feels like too quiet. A blow is coming. You need intensity to feel alive. I left Maxime. Quickly, decisively, the way I was used to doing everything, without hesitation, without looking back. Cut it off. Move on. Don't turn around. We started seeing Vitya. After every fight, Vitya would go silent. Not at home. At the office. He walked past without saying hello. Looked right through me, as if we were strangers. And I said hello. Every time. Smiled, said hi. Pretended everything was fine. Inside, everything was clenched. Outside, hi, how's it going? This is how we began training what would later, in marriage, become 12 consecutive days of silence. But the training started here. Chapter Mother's name was Vitya. The relationship quickly ran its course. Vitya turned out not to be the promise he'd seemed in Mexico. Or more precisely, the promise was mine. I made it up and hung it on a living person who had promised nothing of the kind. He didn't pay me attention. Was cold. Shut down. Stayed silent. Called very rarely. Acted as if we weren't together, but just acquaintances who sometimes crossed paths. I reached out. He pulled away. I tried. He didn't notice. Vitya was intensity. Not because he screamed or made scenes. That came later. But because he was new. Unfamiliar. Unread. I didn't know what he'd say. Couldn't predict him in advance. And I was used to predicting everyone from age 6 by the sound of footsteps. And this unpredictability, which a healthy person might have been warned by, pulled me in. Because in the unpredictability was something that wasn't in Maxime's stability. The feeling that I exist. With Maxime, I was safe. And that's exactly why I left. Because safety I confused with being unneeded. Because when they don't hit you, don't throw you out, don't curse you. A body that grew up with all that doesn't believe it's love. It only believes pain. Vitya didn't resemble my mother, and didn't resemble my grandmother. He resembled a promise. But I didn't know then one thing I would spend 12 years absorbing. The psyche seeks not the best, the familiar. Vitya was cold and like my grandfather, closed off, like my mother. Could scream, like my grandmother. I saw only novelty, like a child walking into a new house, not knowing she's carrying the old one. And then he dumped me, simply. Without a fight, without long conversations, left, and that's it. Like the mother who didn't come for me at nursery school. Like the mother who walked away down the night street and didn't turn around. The first real convulsion of grief happened in the car when he told me. Not tears, not a scream. A convulsion. Physical, as if someone grabbed me from inside by the ribs and started twisting. My body doubled over. My hands shook. I sobbed with contorted hands, couldn't say anything, and Vitya just sat there next to me in silence. He'd already said everything. The grief I didn't live through at 21 when my mother died. The grief I didn't live through at 2 when my mother pushed me off her knees in the courtroom. All of it found a crack and poured out at once, through Vitya, through his leaving, through one more person who looked and decided, "I'm better off without you." And as I sat in that car, the body drew a conclusion. Not the head. The head wasn't working at all. The body, it said, this pain is familiar. Exactly like the pain from my mother. Since I suffered this much from my mother and still love her, it means I love Vitya too, because it hurts this much. It was a trap. Pain was the only proof of love I knew. My grandmother loved and hit. My mother loved and disappeared. My grandfather loved and was silent. In my world, love always came bundled with pain. And when Vitya caused pain, I decided it was love, because there was no other model. I didn't see this then. I would in 12 years. I started chasing him, not beautifully and not proudly. Wrote, called, invented excuses to cross paths, did things I would never have done for myself, because for myself I had no skill at trying, only for others, only for those who leave. 7-year-old me stood at the bus stop alone, after my mother walked away and didn't turn around, and made a decision that turned out to be wrong, run after those who leave. 25-year-old me sat in a car, twisted by a convulsion of grief, and made the same decision, run after Vitya. Chapter Friends with Benefits. So we became friends with benefits. 3 weeks after he dumped me, I started sleeping with him. Without commitments, without status, without promises, just a body next to a body, and the hope that if I was close enough, convenient enough, available enough, he would one day look at me and say, I'm staying. I adjusted in every way, didn't argue, didn't demand, didn't say words that might scare him off, was easy, unburdensome, cheerful, the version of myself that doesn't need, doesn't ask, doesn't pressure. I was playing a role I'd memorized in childhood. Be convenient so you don't lose. Only in childhood the stakes were a place in the house. Now, a place next to a man who'd already decided he was better off without me. It was humiliating, but I didn't feel the humiliation then. I felt the familiar, a known format. Give more than you receive and don't notice the difference. With my grandmother, I gave obedience and received the right not to be thrown out. With my mother, I gave waiting and received nothing. With Vitya, I gave my body, time, care, and received presence without involvement. He wasn't cruel. He simply took what was given and didn't ask why I was giving it. And I gave because I didn't know how to exist next to a person any other way. The childhood formula. Same result. Tolerated, but not chosen. Then we stopped being even that. The benefits ended, friendship remained. If you can call friendship a relationship in which one person hopes and the other doesn't notice, or notices but finds it convenient not to. I don't know what was in his head. I only know what was in mine. Constant, quiet waiting. That he'd understand, that he'd appreciate, that he'd see how much I did for him. That one morning, he'd wake up and look at me, not as a friend, but as a woman he couldn't let go. He didn't wake up. And I waited. The way I waited for my mother, the same position at the door with hope that was already rotting. And then I stopped talking to him. Not because I fell out of love, not because it got easier, but because the relationship was going nowhere. That was the phrase I said out loud. Even rational adult. But inside was the girl who once again stood on the threshold hearing, leave if you don't like it, and left, because staying and waiting hurts more than leaving. I cut contact the way I knew how, sharply, completely, without transition zones. Not let's talk less, not I need a break, but done. Silence. I thought I was making an adult decision. In reality, I was reproducing the only familiar way of coping with pain. Cut it off. If you can't have it, stop wanting. If you can't hold on, let go first. If the person doesn't choose you, disappear before they notice you're still there. The silence didn't last long. After some time, he received a job offer, and life pushed us together again. But this was already a different stage. The stage where I made a decision I would pay for over 12 years. The stage where from friends without commitments, we would become husband and wife. Not out of love, but out of calculation. For a visa, for strategy. But at the moment of the break, I didn't know that yet. I knew only one thing. I had done everything I could. Been convenient, useful, available, quiet, easy, unburdensome. And it still wasn't enough. Like with my grandmother, no matter how hard you try, the A's are still not enough. The house is still not clean enough. You're still not good enough. Like with my mother. No matter how long you wait, she still won't come. I didn't understand then that the problem wasn't that I did too little. The problem was that I wasn't doing it for myself. I was servicing someone else's life and calling it love. I was dissolving into another person and calling it closeness. I was losing myself and calling it a relationship, because that's exactly what I was taught in a house where love looked like work, and work was the only way to earn the right to stay. Chapter the Visa. Meanwhile, Vitya got into Amazon. He received an offer, a job invitation that in our world meant more than any declaration of love. Amazon is not just a company, it's a visa. It's another country. It's the way out. I desperately wanted to leave. Every move had been an escape. Kazakhstan, Siberia. I moved across the map as if somewhere the past would stop reaching. The past moved with me, but I didn't know. America, the West, the place where everything would be different, where my achievements would be worth what they were worth, instead of being devalued with, "So what, everyone lives like that," where no one knows you're an orphan, that your grandmother beat you, that you knelt in corners. There, a new me, the one who could finally breathe, and Vitya was my only way of getting there. I knew this, didn't feel it, knew it, with a cold, calculating mind that had been planning moves ahead its entire life to survive, the mind that at 6 learned to earn money, at 9 to forge a diary, at 17 to push through the jungle. That mind had no illusions about romance. It saw the situation clearly. He has a visa. I have a desire to leave. The formula works. This doesn't mean I felt nothing for him. I did. That same intensity I confused with love. That anxiety I mistook for butterflies. That pain from his rejection I called passion. But alongside it, parallel, not intersecting, lived the calculation. Sober, precise. The childlike calculation of a kid who knows. No one will save you if you don't organize the rescue yourself. Chapter Not Through the Door. I helped him prepare for interviews, sat beside him, broke down questions, suggested how to answer, what to emphasize. Between us, there was an agreement, unspoken, like everything in my life, not written, not signed, existing in the space between words. If he gets through, we leave together. He nodded, probably didn't even understand what I meant. And I took it as a promise. We were no longer together, not even friends with benefits, nothing. Two people who once slept together and were now just acquaintances. And then he got the offer. I called to congratulate, as an acquaintance, as an ex, as a person who helped prepare and had the right to be happy about the result. And then, a coincidence that turned out not to be so coincidental. Shortly before, I had fallen and split my elbow, badly, with blood. I have von Willebrand disease. My blood doesn't clot properly. They put me in the hospital. Vitya visited, sat beside me, took care of me, the way he knew how, silently, practically, without words. And in that care, something shifted, not in him, in me. Because care, even silent, even clumsy, for a girl who hadn't been visited in the hospital since age 6, that's a lot. That's almost everything. After the hospital, we ended up close again. After the offer, even closer. And sex happened, the first since the breakup. And here is where I did what I did. I didn't talk honestly, didn't say, "Vitya, I need help. I want to leave. Take me with you." I asked, but not with words. During sex, through the body, through the only language in which I knew how to get what I needed, at the moment when he would definitely not refuse, when the body had already said yes, and adding, "Take me with you," was no longer a request. It was a deal he entered without noticing. Because with words I couldn't, words require admitting, "I need something from you. I'm asking. Help me." And asking was forbidden since childhood. Every request in my life ended the same way, worse than before it. The body learned a request equals punishment and learned something else. If you can't ask, earn it. Go around. Become so necessary that refusing is impossible. I didn't ask. I manipulated. Not because I was cunning, but because I didn't know another way. Back then it felt like a victory. Now I see the beginning of the reckoning, he agreed. We became a couple again, and I thought the plan had worked. That I'd push through again, like through the jungle at university, like always. Back then I saw only this. The visa, the calculation, the deal. I didn't see the other thing. That he agreed. That he took on someone else's life. Silently, without bargaining, without conditions. Later I would understand. His yeah wasn't indifference. It was his version of, you made your bed. He didn't know how to say, I choose you. But every time something needed doing, he did it. Silently, the way he was taught. Later, after 10 years, I would write him a letter. Long, honest, written from a place where there was nothing left to lose. And in that letter would be words that made even me flinch. I used you, and I got the reckoning. The reckoning was 10 years in which the script didn't change. He didn't need to invest. He got everything anyway. And I contorted myself in every way, hoping he'd love me someday. Like with my grandmother. One more A, one more clean notebook, one more flawless day, and maybe today she won't hit. But back then that evening, there was no reckoning yet. There was only his yes, his hands, the offer that meant California, and me, the girl who had just gotten what she wanted, the only way she knew how. I laid the foundation of a house in which I would suffocate for 12 years. The relationship was built not on a request, on a deal. Who's to blame? I asked myself that in the same letter, and answered myself. The chain went back to infinity. On each link, not someone guilty, but someone who didn't know any other way. And I, on my link, also didn't know. With Vitya, I went around through the bedroom. The door opened, but behind it was not what I'd imagined. Chapter: Marriage of Convenience. To file for an H-1B visa, you had to be married, and the filing had to happen within a week. In Russia, getting married in a week is impossible. The queue, the paperwork, a month of waiting, impossible for an ordinary person. For me, impossible hadn't existed since childhood. I bought a pregnancy certificate. I wasn't pregnant. I would be later, but not yet. Just a certificate. A piece of paper with a stamp that gave the right to expedited registration. Then I called people I knew. Do you know anyone at the ZAGS, the Russian Civil Registry Office? I need to get married urgently this week. Found someone, paid a bribe, arranged everything, organized it all myself. Quickly, precisely, without extra emotion, as if solving a work task with a deadline. We drove to the ZAGS in a neighboring city right before a work meeting. Vitya wore whatever he was wearing. I wore whatever I was wearing. No dress, no ring, no getting down on one knee with "Be my wife." I handed over the gift. They stamped us in exchange, and we drove to work. A formality, a checkbox. Done. That is how I got married. Between two work meetings, with a fake certificate in my bag and a stamp in my passport that meant nothing except visa status. I stood in that ZAGS and felt nothing. Not joy, not solemnity, not even relief. Just a cold business-like satisfaction. Task completed. Next item, visa paperwork. Later I thought many times, maybe if there had been a dress, a ring, words, something would have gone differently. If he had gotten on one knee and said, I want you to be my wife. Not for a visa, not for a yeah, but because he chose me. Maybe I would have felt not like a resource, but like a woman. But there was none of that, and I didn't grieve it then, because I didn't know you could grieve it. I didn't know a wedding could be a celebration, that a bride could be not a strategist, but simply happy. In my house, there was not a single story of a happy marriage. Not one example of a man looking at a woman and saying, you are mine. I choose you. And somewhere very deep behind all the layers of control and calculation lived a little girl who wanted someone, just once in her life, to choose her not for usefulness, but just because. And that girl, on that day, once again didn't get what she wanted, and once again stayed silent. But Vitya didn't win the visa. The H-1B is a lottery, and we lost. The certificate, the ZAGS, the bribe, the stamp between two meetings, all of it was for nothing. Or not entirely for nothing. We were now married, and that couldn't be rewound like a tape. But America, the reason it all started, was closed. Fine, what's plan B? And the process with Canada began. Chapter Pregnancy. I really wanted a child from Vanya then. It was real, genuine, bodily desire. Not from the head, not from a plan, not from strategy. I wanted it as if something inside had woken up and said, now, right now, not later, not someday. Now, while there's still time. Because the doctor said I was going to die soon. The bleeding that started after my mother's death had by then become a threat. Von Willebrand disease. Rare, hereditary, the kind where blood doesn't clot properly. Blood was pouring out during periods, and the hemophilia injections had stopped helping. They told me straight, this can't go on. The body, which already didn't know how to relax, how to sleep, how to stop, now also didn't know how to hold blood. As if it had decided to fulfill my grandmother's curse literally, you'll die like your mother. My mother died at 42. I was 30. And somewhere inside, in the place where what lives isn't thoughts but knowings, I was certain. There wasn't much time left. And then I lost it. That's how I later described it, with the honesty that only comes after many years. I suddenly wanted a child. Didn't decide, didn't plan, wanted. As if leaving behind a person would make death not quite death. As if a child were proof that I existed, that I was here, that it wasn't all for nothing. My mother left nothing behind except me, and she didn't even raise me. I wanted to leave behind someone I would raise, whom I wouldn't abandon, to whom I'd say what no one said to me. When Vitya agreed to our business marriage, I heard in it that he too wanted a child like I did. I didn't actually ask him. I began dreaming of how it would happen. I imagined an evening, and in that evening, candles were burning. Many candles. As if light is what should be present when a new life begins. As if the child should arrive not in darkness, but in warmth. A month passed. My 30th birthday came. I came home from work. And a surprise. Vitya and friends had prepared everything. The whole room was filled with balloons and flowers, and candles were burning. Those very candles I had imagined. The cake also had candles. I stood before that cake, and something rose inside, for which I can't find a word. Not joy, not excitement, but recognition, as if I had already seen this moment, as if life had finally matched the picture I'd drawn for myself. I blew out the candles and made a wish for him to be born to us. And that very evening, my wish came true. I found out 2 weeks later, and jumped for joy like a child who was given for the first time what they asked for. And so I was pregnant. In the 6th month, I wrote my son a letter in a notebook. Hi, Arseny. I'm Vera, your mom. You're not born yet. I'm on my 6th month now. We really look forward to your arrival in the fall. And for now, you live in my tummy, and you're actively moving around, kicking and even hiccuping. Your dad and I really wanted you to come, and a miracle happened. You chose us and decided to be born into our family. I wrote and believed every word. I described how I made a wish on my 30th birthday, how I blew out the candles, how that very evening I got pregnant, how I jumped for joy when I found out, how I knew right away it would be a boy, not from tests, but simply knew, how for the past several years I'd sensed the presence of a boy nearby when I came home from work, as if someone was already standing there waiting. Arseny, that was my best birthday ever. Son, thank you for fulfilling my wish. I wrote to him about Vitya. That papa was amazing. The best man in the world. Smart, responsible, courageous. That he was valued at work. That he was my colleague. That he took care of me throughout the pregnancy. Arseny, I really want you to be like your papa. All of this was true. And at the same time, not the whole truth. Because alongside these words, a few pages later in the same notebook, I wrote something else. if I'm no longer here? I was 30. I was in my 6th month, and I was writing my unborn son instructions in case of my death. Whatever the circumstances of my death, please do not take it personally. It is not and cannot be your fault. Those were the very words no one said to me when my mother died. The ones I'd been searching for 20 years and never found. The ones whose absence left me living with the belief that my mother's death was my fault. I wrote them for my son because I knew, if I die, he will need exactly these words. My main request to you, do something good with your life and my memory. We come to this earth to learn. In any situation, ask yourself, what can I learn from this? I love you and your papa. Arseny, I bless you. Take from me and from your papa all the best. P.S. Red Books. A 30-year-old woman in her 6th month writes a will and a love letter in the same notebook with the same pen in the same handwriting, preparing for death and for birth at the same time. And this wasn't a contradiction. This was my life, the one where beginning and end always stood too close together. And then 4 years later, I found that notebook while packing boxes for the move to California and added to it. Hooray, found this notebook. I've been wanting to write down what we called you. Froggy Jumpy, Paw Scratchy, Bitey Chewy, Tiger Shechka, Kitten Cub, Kisyavka, Kisyatina, Sweetheart, Dear Beloved Son, Sunny Kittenachek. Your funny words, Markatix, Faliatix, Emilian, Googleplex, more things we called you, Marochkin, Kotyanochkin, Kitten Tiger Cub, Tigriusha, Kitriusha, Paw Scratcher, Little Devil with a Fluffy Tail, Chertyaka, Cherbarsik. 23 nicknames, I counted them later. 23 names for one small person. A woman who couldn't say, I love you, said it in 23 ways. Through Tigriushechka, through Kisyavka, through the Little Devil with the Fluffy Tail. Note, Kisyavka and Kisyatina mean I'm angry, but I love you. I didn't know how to love with words, but the body knew. The body invented names. The body lay next to him every evening. The body woke at 5 in the morning to make him breakfast. The body won court cases so they wouldn't take him. The body chose him every time, even when the head wanted to die. Arsenyika. From birth, you were a choleric. An Italian family, we are all cholerics. You run up the walls. We run through the corridors, trying to somehow burn off your wild energy. And we also crawl on all fours and meow, because you're a kitten and I'm your mama cat. Mama cat. I wrote that 5 years before I adopted a real cat from a shelter. 5 years before I began learning to love. Through Lapa, through a wild creature that bites and doesn't trust. I was already a mama cat. I just didn't know. 23 nicknames. I counted them later. 23 names for one tiny person who hadn't even been born yet. Not a single one. From the head. All from somewhere else. From the place the head didn't control. I didn't know how to love with words. But the body knew. The body invented 23 words for love before the child was even born. And not a single one for fear. Although fear was there, it was always there. Arsenyika, from birth you were a choleric. An Italian family in one body. Restless, loud. In the maternity ward they said, yours is screaming the loudest. I lay and smiled. That's my boy. Mama cat. I wrote that 5 years before I adopted a real cat from a shelter. The image was already there. The warmth was already there. It just hadn't found a body yet. Chapter, The First Time. I unclench my stomach. For the first time in my life, the corset loosened. Not because I learned to relax, but because inside me someone was growing who needed space. I got pregnant and something strange happened. I slowed down. For the first time in my life, Vicha became tender and sweet. The way I'd seen him in Mexico when everything was just beginning. He cared, he was present, He looked at me as if I mattered not for my function, but simply because I was carrying our child. I was calm and fluid like never before. The body, which since childhood had lived strapped into a corset, stomach pulled in, jaw clenched, neck tense, for the first time began letting go. I remember the moment. I relaxed my abs for the first time. Simply stopped pulling them in, the stomach I'd held tight my whole life. For posture, for control, for the illusion that I could handle everything alone, for the first time became soft. Because inside it now was someone, and for that someone, I could unclench. I was a very intentional mother. I decided this before the pregnancy, long before. Decided it the way I decided everything in life. Absolutely and irreversibly. My child would grow up differently. Without beatings. Without corners. Without torn notebooks. Everything that happened to me would not happen to him. I was happy to learn I was pregnant. Vitya was happy too. And for a time, maybe a few weeks, maybe a couple of months, it seemed like life was finally on track. That the terrible things were behind me. That this child was my chance to do right what went wrong with my mother. But even in this calm, which was the deepest peace of my life, a crack lived. I was waiting for what everyone talked about. The hormonal rush of love, the oxytocin that was supposed to flood me with warmth, turn me into a soft, glowing, pregnant woman from the magazines. It didn't come. I was still productive at work, logical, collected, operating in survival mode. Only now that mode ran quieter. I couldn't talk to my belly. Other women rubbed their bellies and whispered something tender, and I stood in front of the mirror not knowing what to say to the person inside me. As if between us was the same glass wall that stood between me and every person in my life. Visible, but not touching. I didn't understand why then. Didn't understand that a woman who was never loved unconditionally, who was abandoned at 6 months, beaten and thrown out, cursed and shamed, that woman can't simply, on the command of hormones, switch on what was never there. Tenderness toward a small creature requires the experience of tenderness toward your own small self. And my small self was still kneeling in the corner, not knowing it could be otherwise. For 7 years, I worked on forgiving my mother. 7, 8 years of therapy, constellation work, books, practices, but not a single day, not one, did I work on my grandmother. Because I didn't consider that anything was wrong with my childhood. I lived with the belief my grandmother planted so deep, it became invisible. This is normal. Everyone lives like this. You were lucky. You should be grateful. And so I stood with a growing belly, in the quietest period of my life, in the only peace I'd been given, and couldn't say to the child inside me, I love you. Not because I didn't love him, but because the words got stuck in the same place where everything had gotten stuck since childhood. In the throat, behind clenched jaws, behind a bitten tongue. Somewhere between not allowed and don't know how. And then something else rose. I needed to buy things for the baby. Make a list. Go to the store. Pick out a crib. Diapers. Bottles. A simple task. Any woman in her 7th month has long since done this. Set up the room, wash the tiny onesies, organize them in drawers. I couldn't. Put it off day after day. The task seemed harder than calculus at university. I didn't understand why. Every time I thought about baby things, something rose inside that had no name. Not joy, not anticipation. Something like rebellion. As if the hurt child inside me crossed her arms and said, "No, I won't." Tiny onesies didn't bring tenderness. They brought the urge to run. I thought, you can use a box instead of a crib. Why spend money? And then the part I hated most surfaced, cruel, cold, the one that can't stand the weak and helpless, that can only talk to children as if they're adults, in a serious voice with high demands, without affection. A tender tone just didn't work for her. At all. I ran scenarios in my head. What will I do if he won't eat? What if he won't listen? And my reactions in those scenarios were identical to my grandmother's. And one more thing. When I saw other mothers very warm, smiling, those who rubbed their bellies and cooed, I was hit with hysteria. Every time. As if someone else's tenderness toward a child landed in the place where my tenderness should have been, and found emptiness. In the 7th month, it all finally broke through. I looked around and saw nothing had been bought, not a single thing, and I was hit with a verdict. I'm a bad mother. Before the child was even born, like her. Like my mother, who didn't come for me at nursery school. Who chose the bottle over milk. I hadn't given birth yet, and was already repeating. I had to go to therapist Tanya. She found the formula that was running everything. I'm not good enough. That's my motivator. I still haven't come up with a better one. And one more thing. What I couldn't say aloud, but Tanya named for me. I'm the same as my mother. No love for the child. No patience. I want to die. And that seems more noble than abandoning him. I haven't given birth yet, and I'm already repeating. So I'm bad too. Tanya said 4 words. There is nothing wrong with you. I carried them inside me for a month like a talisman. A month after the session, the feeling still remained that who I am is right. That there is nothing wrong with me. Because before that, no one, not once in 30 years, had said those words to me. By then, the uterus was already dancing. Premature contractions, the doctors called a threat. The body, which had only just learned to unclench, clenched again, because the same fear that had lived there since birth rose. I'm a bad mother. But for now, there was still peace. Vitya was still tender. It still seemed like the child would change everything, that with his birth a different life would begin, one where I would finally be not an orphan but a mother, a real warm, intentional mother who would do everything right. I didn't know that motherhood would become the very mirror in which I'd see everything I'd been running from, that the child I'd decided to protect from my childhood would show me that childhood in full, that I would become what I feared becoming. But that would come later. For now, silence, a soft belly, and the hope that this time it would work. Chapter Field Tree Storm. I went to Seversk to give birth because in Novosibirsk they took the baby away after delivery to let the just-delivered mother rest, and joint delivery wasn't allowed unless you paid. Some procedure, some law, some bureaucratic logic that to a woman in her 9th month sounds not like a legal nuance, but like a threat. Takeaway. The baby. Mine. No, not that. I'll go anywhere as long as they don't take him. As if one childhood wasn't enough. In which they took everything. My mother's safety. The right to be a child. Now they could take mine. We drove 5 hours on a bumpy road from Novosibirsk to Seversk with contractions. Road GPS, breathing, endure. And then the GPS said, "You have arrived." We looked around. A field, empty, flat, endless. And in the middle of it, one tree. And above the field, on a storm. Black sky, lightning, wind, and a lone tree that, by all laws of physics, the lightning should strike. We stood on the shoulder, with contractions, with a GPS that lied about arriving, with a storm overhead, and I remember not fear. I remember the absurdity, as if someone up there decided to joke, "You wanted to reach safety? Here's a field, a tree, and lightning. Figure it out. Seversk is a closed military city, a restricted access Soviet-era city. To enter, you need to apply for a special pass 6 months in advance. Entry through a single checkpoint. But Vitya typed Seversk into the GPS, not the checkpoint, but the city itself. And Google, obedient and dumb, drove us to the outskirts, to a fence behind which the city existed, but no road led to it. A pregnant woman with contractions, a storm, a field, and a GPS that thinks we've arrived. We found the checkpoint, drove in. They admitted me to the hospital in a city where I knew no one. And then began 5 days I would later remember not as labor, but as an endurance test, for which I long had no resources. Contractions came every evening, real strong, promising, and faded by 5 or 6 in the morning. No result, as if the body started to deliver and changed its mind. The body was saying, it's not safe yet. I didn't sleep. 5 days, not a single night. Contractions wouldn't let me sleep. And when they faded, anxiety wouldn't. The body couldn't sleep in an unfamiliar place. It hadn't been able to sleep since I was 21 and my mother died. It couldn't relax at all. Since birth, since my grandmother's don't relax, something bad will happen. And now, at the very moment when relaxing was essential, so the body could open, so the baby could come out, it couldn't. As if the corset I'd worn since childhood had clamped not only the muscles, but the womb. As if the body was saying, I don't know how to let go. No one taught me that. They taught me to hold. I didn't complain. Didn't call friends. Didn't write anyone. On the 6th day, they induced with medication. Too long on antibiotics. Dangerous for the baby. I knew this and was afraid. Afraid for him, not for myself. For myself, I'd stopped being afraid long ago. But for him, for the little one who wasn't yet born and already depended on whether I could endure, I was afraid in a way I'd never been. August 2015, joint delivery. Vitya was there, a room full of doctors. There were many, because they were afraid of losing me. Von Willebrand disease, blood doesn't clot, hemophilia injections that were supposed to help, didn't. I saw the fear on their faces, read it instantly, with the same skill I developed before I learned to read letters. In the doctor's eyes, I knew. They think I could die. And I lay there thinking not about death. I was thinking, if I die, he won't have a mother, like me. I didn't die. Arseny was born. The first thing he did in this life was pee on the nurse, a little fountain, right in her face. She was holding him, small, wet, screaming, and he produced a stream with the precision only someone who has absolutely no regard for social norms is capable of. The nurse gasped. Someone laughed. Then they gave him to me. I held him and didn't know how. He was small and warm and silent, and I was silent. There was no milk. My breasts swelled, nipples cracked, but the milk wouldn't come, as if something inside was blocked. The same pipe through which tenderness was supposed to flow, clogged. The one that was shut off at 6 months when mother disappeared. I had nothing to feed my child, and that feeling, nothing, wasn't about milk. It was about everything. Arseny got jaundice immediately. Yellow, tiny, sleeping all the time. They treated him. It didn't help. At night he woke for an hour or two, and during those hours I didn't sleep because I was afraid that if I closed my eyes, something would happen. During the day, I didn't sleep because I couldn't. The body didn't know how to sleep with a dependent creature nearby. The hypervigilance that had scanned my grandmother's footsteps all its life now scanned the breathing of an infant. Hospital room, yellow light, beeping machines, a baby with jaundice, and me, alone, like at 6 years old in the hospital, when my grandmother dropped off food and staying with a child was not the custom. Vitya got drunk the first night after the delivery, celebrating, didn't congratulate me, didn't call until the next evening. I couldn't walk from the pain, and he was celebrating. This would later become one of those details I'd remember again and again, each time with the same burning in my chest. I had just given birth. I almost died, and he was celebrating his contribution. Chapter the First Crack. And in the middle of all of this, the insomnia, the jaundice, the absence of milk, the body refusing to obey, Vitya and I had our first rupture. Trying to squeeze out at least some milk through cracked nipples, I said to Vitya in hysteria, I hate children, like a dam that held 20 years of water, and it finally burst, not where it should have, not when it could have, but right now, right here, right in the face of the only person nearby. Vitya screamed back. Of course he was frightened himself and didn't know how to help. For the first time ever, in all the time we were together, he had never once raised his voice at me, and suddenly, a scream, not annoyed, not tired. He said, I'll take the baby. He said, you can get the hell out. The air left the room, my body compressed to a point. I was on hormones, had just given birth, hadn't slept in weeks. I had no milk, no strength, not a single square centimeter inside that wasn't in pain, and the only adult nearby, the only person who was supposed to be on my side, was telling me to leave. The body recognized those words instantly, before the head, before I had time to feel hurt or frightened. The body recognized the tone, my grandmother's. The body recognized the formula, don't like it, leave. The body recognized the look, bulging eyes, clenched teeth, the face of a person about to hit. My grandmother looked like that before she hit, and now Vitya looked the same. He didn't hit, he never did, but the body doesn't distinguish. For the body, a scream and the threat, I'll take the baby, were the same as my grandmother's scream and the threat, I'll send you to an orphanage. Same frequency, same internal address, same feeling. I'm not needed. I'm about to be discarded, and the baby will be taken because I'm bad. Bad granddaughter, bad daughter, and now bad mother too. In that moment, something cracked inside. Didn't break. The full break would take another 12 years. But it cracked so deep that afterward the crack never healed, no matter how I tried. It ran not between me and Vitya. It ran through me. Between the part that still believed this marriage could become a family, and the part that in the moment of his scream understood, I'm in the same house again. Different walls, different address, different person, but the same house. Where they scream, where they threaten, where love sounds like, get the hell out. Vitya would later say he wanted to protect Arseny, that he was scared, that he didn't really think that. Maybe. But the body had already recorded. The body recorded, if you show weakness, if you tell the truth, if you admit you're not coping, you'll be thrown out. And the baby will be taken. The same formula as grandmother's. The same price for honesty. The same reckoning for being alive. Not a function. After that day, something changed forever. Not on the outside. On the outside, everything stayed the same. We lived in the same apartment, slept in the same bed, looked like a family. But inside me, a wall appeared that hadn't been there before. Thin, invisible, impenetrable. A wall behind which I hid what I actually felt. And from that day, I never again told him the truth about how bad things were. Not because I didn't want to. But because the body remembered what happens when you speak. Beside me was a person who screams when I'm suffering, like my grandmother, and there is no protection, like in childhood. All that was left was one thing. Close off. Become convenient. Stop feeling. Put the corset back on, the one I'd briefly taken off during pregnancy, and pull through. The way I always pulled through. The way I pulled through my whole life. Teeth clenched, stomach pulled in, dry eyes, and a feeding schedule on the refrigerator. This was the first time I noticed the repetition. Didn't understand, noticed. As if for a fraction of a second a light flashed and showed, you've been here before. This scream, familiar. This silence, familiar. The light went out. But something inside remembered. Chapter Toronto. When Arseny was 3 months old, we moved to Canada on November 17th, 2015, to a country with no friends and no family. Before leaving, we had to get him a passport. And for the passport, a photo. Try photographing a three-month-old infant so he's looking at the camera, eyes open, white background, no pacifier, no hands in the frame. That's a separate quest not described in any immigration guide. We managed. In Toronto, I pulled myself together and became fully functional. Vitya didn't speak English. Finding housing, buying a car, filing paperwork, setting up daily life, all of it fell on me. I made a plan, took on all the negotiations, tracked Arseny's sleep schedule to the minute, didn't rest, barely slept. But the plan worked, because a plan is what I'd done best since age 6. Vitya worked 14 hours so we wouldn't lose the visa. Didn't complain. Didn't ask for help. Pulled through silently. His way of loving. Doing. Without saying. And then I saw a different side of Vitya. He started working at Amazon and found himself under pressure he wasn't prepared for. Financial responsibility for 3. English that wasn't enough. workwear for the first months he understood nothing, stress piled up with no outlet. The outlet found itself through me. He became irritable, screamed, looked at me with contempt, not sometimes, but most of the time. The face I would later describe in a letter 10 years later, a loud voice, bulging eyes, clenched teeth, as if about to attack, as if I were a problem that needed to be removed from the room. He didn't help with the baby. Not because he refused, I didn't ask. When I left in the morning for a run, to lose weight and become more beautiful for him, so he'd finally stop looking at me with contempt, he simply slept. Didn't get up for larceny. I came back, guilty for leaving the child, though the child was with his father. But the father was sleeping. And then the silence would begin. Vitya could go without speaking to me for 12 days straight. 12. He walked around the apartment, ate, worked, looked at his phone, and acted as if I didn't exist. Not demonstratively. Just as if no one was in the room. As if I were a wall, furniture, background. He too was in a foreign country. Also without friends, without language, without support. His silence was not punishment. It was his way of coping. Retreating inward. Closing off. Waiting it out. The way grandfather retreated to the garage, the way I retreated into function. Two people from the same kind of homes, with the same skill, endure in silence. And every one of those days, I was dying inside. Not from anger, from recognition. My grandmother punished with silence. Stop speaking. Stop noticing. And you walk through the house like a ghost, waiting to be seen again. To be allowed to exist again. Vitya's silence hit the same spot, the same place inside where the child lived who had been punished with invisibility. I didn't ask for anything, but I tried different things to appease him. Cooked him food, delicious, proper, as expected, wore long skirts. Valieva, the author I was reading then, wrote that a woman should be feminine, soft, in a skirt, and then the man would appreciate her. I believed it. Put on the skirt, tied my hair, cooked dinner, set the plate before a husband who looked at me with contempt and believed that if I were proper enough, feminine enough, quiet enough, he'd stop screaming. He'd see me, he'd love me, like grandmother would love me if I got an A, like mother would come back if I was good. Same logic, same promise, same result. Nothing changed. I didn't ask for help, gave him massages. Gave him oral sex, because without sex, he became even more irritable, and living in the same space with that irritation was unbearable. I drank so I could have sex with him, because sober, when you're being treated like that, I couldn't. He never started with romance and tenderness, just kissed when he wanted, and I understood, time to perform. I wasn't ready, but I drank and gave, because that was my function. Wife, mother, servant. Everything he wanted, and nothing of who I actually was. I was stockpiling resentment without noticing. Hatred grew inside like water behind a dam, and on the outside I smiled and wore skirts. The same formula as with my grandmother, bending over backward to please. And from them, not a word of gratitude, no love. I was losing my mind. Not metaphorically, literally. From the sheer number of days without sleep, the brain starts working differently. Reality drifts. Sounds get louder. Light gets brighter. Thoughts stop forming sentences. You look at the child and don't understand what to do with him. You hold him in your arms and don't feel your arms. And through it all, you keep going. Sleep schedule, healthy food, playgrounds, like a robot. To stop means admitting you're not coping. And that's been forbidden since age 5, when larceny was teething. He screamed for 3 hours straight. During the day, I was alone. After an hour of screaming, I started screaming at the wall. Not at him, at the wall. Because you can't scream at the baby. But inside, there was more than could be contained. I was not a mother. I was a desperate child. Without empathy, without resources, without support. Like back then, on my knees in the corner. Back then, I didn't know you could ask for help. That I'm not coping is not a death sentence. Then I started drinking. Not binges, a glass, two in the evening. When I was angry at Vitya. When I was angry at Arsini from exhaustion. When despair came so close that the only way to push it back was the bottle on the kitchen counter. After some time, I don't remember how long, the days blurred, I stopped getting up, just lay on the floor while Arsini crawled next to me, small, warm, alive, crawling around my body which lay there not moving. Not because I didn't want to get up, because I couldn't. The body said, done. And I lay there and watched my son crawl around me and thought one thing. I'm a bad mother. Like her. Like my mother who abandoned me. I hadn't abandoned yet, but I'm lying on the floor while my child crawls next to me. How is this different? Guilt pressed down from above. Shame won't let you get up. Shame takes the last of what you have. After 2 weeks without sleep in Toronto, I decided to jump from the 17th floor. At night, I got up and went to the balcony. Not because I wanted to die, but because the despair reached the point where the body searches for any exit, any door, any end. It wasn't death I wanted. I wanted it to stop. That night, Vitya woke up for some reason, saw me on the balcony, led me back to the bedroom. But after that, nothing changed. He didn't ask what happened or how I got to that point. Just went back to sleep. Morning, as if nothing happened. Like after the knife at grandmother's, porridge, garage, school. Childbirth turned out not to be the beginning of a new life. A child who depends on an adult and the adult isn't coping. A mother who is physically present but emotionally absent. A scream that is followed not by comfort but by a louder scream. Everything I'd been running from seeped through me like water through a crack in the wall. And I understood. Everything I'd been running from seeped through me. The crack wasn't in the wall. The crack was in me. Chapter Detective. The understanding that a child is not only a mother but also a father began with my first constellation session where I had to place him. My request was about inability to accept myself. Such anger opened up in me toward him. I was surprised. I was 25 then. 25? And for the first time I allowed myself to be angry at a person I didn't even know. At an empty space in my biography. At a hole my grandmother had papered over with a fake patronymic and silence. The topic of my father was never raised in our home. I didn't know that my surname and patronymic had been changed by my mother when I was two. The word was never even spoken in our house. I have very faint memories from around age two of being called names. Tatarva, a slur for Tatar people, Vera Rivkatovna, and Satarova. But the memories are so faint I don't trust them. I am Vera Vladimirovna, not Satarova, according to my duplicate birth certificate and passport. Grandmother's surname plus a patronymic from who knows whom. Just sounds nice with the first name. And there's no one left to ask. No relatives have been alive for a long time, and there were barely any to begin with. After the constellation session, I began searching for my father. Found someone. Got inspired. But it turned out it wasn't him. And how could I know for sure? I didn't know his full name or date of birth. I searched approximately by surname through social media. That first search attempt was 7 years ago. I dropped it for a while. Then after the move to Canada, I unexpectedly learned from my 75-year-old grandfather that my mother and father had been briefly married. Grandpa's old, could have mixed things up. But I got hope. A marriage registration is a lead. I hired a detective remotely from Canada. He took the money and dragged it out for a long time, about 6 months. What I went through during those 6 months waiting for news. That I'd find my father today, and he died yesterday. Such pain and guilt. That I'd find him and he doesn't want to know me. Fear. That I'd never find him and would live in uncertainty my whole life. Despair. And I so wanted clarity. It's such a natural desire. To know your parents. The detective scammed me. Disappeared with the money. And no search results. The feeling of betrayal was also bitter. I so wanted to do everything in my power. I survived the pain and hired another detective through a connection. He found the information in 3 days. Hooray! Sattarov Rifkat Rafikovich, born January the 25th, 1962. Waiting for details. First, euphoria. Tears of joy. 2 minutes later, a WhatsApp message. I'm afraid to disappoint you. According to this data, he's not in the passport database. Either he left Kazakhstan or he's no longer alive. Tears of such despair. After some time, I receive more news from the second detective about my father. They found his brother, who is paralyzed and can't speak. Spoke with the brother's wife, Aliona. My father died about 9 years ago, the same year as my mother, from alcoholism. It turns out I have 2 half-sisters from different marriages. All 3, including me, grew up without a father. Grief washes over me, and such a trembling of the heart that I barely coped. This Aliona was so warm toward me, unexpectedly so. She gave me the contact of the only surviving sister of my father, an aunt. The next day I called this aunt. The aunt was cold, said she'd never heard of Rifkat having a daughter with a girl who was in prison. Said Rifkat only had one marriage, that he met his wife on a train. There was one daughter with whom they never maintained contact, and that's definitely not me. Oh, right, my mother and father met not on a train but at the zone, in prison, where my mother at 22 was serving her sentence, and he was a warrant officer, basically a guard. I went through such swings in those 2 days, mourning a biological father, and then the realization that it was all a farce and it wasn't him. My heart clenched and dropped. It's all a coincidence, and he's not my father. I can't even describe that feeling. The only lead, the aunt, confirmed that her brother Rifkat was also a warrant officer at the Karaganda prison, where I flew at age 5 with my grandmother to visit my mother, who was serving time for the second time. I called Aliona, retold what the aunt said about not knowing me. Aliona suddenly started remembering how Rifkat brought me to her to babysit, which she hadn't mentioned in the previous conversation, when I was 6 months old and Rifkat and my mother lived with Rifkat's parents. My grandfather had told me about this. At least something matches, Aliona. Rifkat often came drunk at night and wanted to take you, but I wouldn't let him. What if he dropped you? And where was my mother at that time? Oh, they partied and drank separately, fought a lot, and split up. Disappointment that he was the same as my mother. Not ready for children, young, coped with problems through alcohol. I so hoped for a happy ending. That's it. The story ends there. No photos of my father. No solid proof he's my father. How can you trust a woman who even confuses brothers' names in conversation and the number of daughters? No clarity whatsoever. I don't have 2 sisters. Aliona confused it with another of my father's brothers, but just 1 in Russia, and even her name is unknown. And I seriously doubt Aliona's information. Why was all of this for? Friends ask me, why the hell are you even looking for your father? You have a husband and a son. I think it's such a natural desire to know your parents that I'm almost offended that my closest friends don't understand asking such a question. Maybe it's just biology? Who knows? I have no rational explanation for why I searched. I only know that. I will never talk to even one of my parents. He will never say, we wanted you. You were so important to us. Words I say to my son almost every day. Words I so want to hear myself. I will never learn that he became a worthy person and that abandoning me, a baby, was just a youthful mistake. And he repents. And he achieved a lot. I will never be able to tell him what I achieved, so he could be proud of me. I will never be able to say dad or my father. I will never know what he was like when young, what his personality was, how they met with my mother, and what drew him to her. What could I have needed this experience for, to be able to understand others, even in their hardest youthful mistakes, to be able to understand self-rejection, and share how to get out and find yourself, to be able to value life just because without any given circumstances, life as it is, imperfect, to be able to love yourself without an example, with all your heart as best you can, and through this experience, to love others. Asterisk, asterisk, asterisk. My story didn't end there, as it turned out. I'm adding to it 2 weeks later. What happened the day I wrote this story? I read it about 20 times until I could read it without tears, especially the ending. I felt lighter. I exhaled and decided to share the story with my closest friends on WhatsApp. By a lucky coincidence, lucky, I accidentally sent the story to a distant relative on my mother's side. I received a reply 10 minutes later. Vera, ahai! Why did you waste your nerves, money, and time searching for your father? Couldn't you ask relatives about it? For example, me? Your mother and I were only 4 years apart in age. She was older than me, and that's why we communicated more than anyone else. I'll tell you that the person in the photo was never your father. They met when you already existed and lived together only a few months, and you were born to a man who lived, and maybe still lives, on Krylova Street. His name really is Vladimir. Your patronymic is real, but I don't remember his last name. A soap opera, like the children of Captain Grant, who sailed nearby the whole time but in the wrong direction. I sat in silence for 15 minutes. No words. My husband thought someone had died. The patronymic is real. Vladimirovna. Not sounds nice with the first name, but real. I went to sleep because feeling emotions that day was physically beyond me. I felt emotional exhaustion. Familiar. The same as after grandmother's beatings in childhood, when the body simply shut down. Not from tiredness, but from overload. From the impossibility of fitting in one more thing. And I woke up, strangely, a happy person. Literally an order of magnitude happier than before. It let go. I don't want to search for Vladimir, and I'm not going to. I don't feel the need. It became unimportant to me how all of this happened and why things worked out this way. In my body, there's this feeling of, it's neither bad nor good. These things happen. Specifically, not a thought, but a state in the body that appears when I think about my father. A quiet happiness and a smile. Warmth in the soul. At first, my brain worried that this state of non-judgment would pass. This only happens to enlightened people, I thought. Turns out ordinary people can access it too. Apparently it appears when a person gets tired of suffering. 2 weeks passed, and every time I remember my father, my heart feels warm. I smile. Now I know how a completed gestalt feels. The situation hasn't changed, but the person feels good. Adding to this 4 months later, because the saga continues, I closed my gestalt 4 months ago, but fate offered me to finish closing it today. I received a message from Aunt Larissa. My father, Vladimir, knew about me the whole time and lived in the same building as me. Found your biological father. He lives on Krylova. His last name is Panchishko Vladimir, born 1963. He's paralyzed. You have a brother and a sister. We talked on the phone. She told me my grandmother was against him seeing me. He was on drugs, like my mother, and both were persona non grata. Larissa remembers how my grandmother often mentioned the biological father's last name in conversation. Vera is the spitting image of Pancha. Such a wave of anger and tears rose in me. Why did grandmother interfere at all? I lost so many years not knowing my father. I have the right to know my parents by the right of my birth. An outraged voice sounded in my head. A childlike voice, practically a toddler tantrum. The part that lived 30 years without the word dad, and suddenly learned that dad lived in the next building. I'm sitting in a cafe, sobbing. Immediately, the part of me that desperately and fruitlessly strives toward enlightenment started lecturing. Grandmother surely had good intentions. People always have good intentions, and who knows who you'd have become if you'd found out earlier. To which my ordinary human part told that enlightened voice to fuck off, and simply continued crying and being angry at grandmother. Grandmother was protecting. I understand this now, with my head. She was protecting from a drug addict, from an alcoholic, from a person who couldn't raise a child. She protected the only way she knew, by cutting off. Half an hour later, Having calmed down, I called my father. "Hello, I'm Vera." His first words, "Well, don't be too hard on me. We were young." I hadn't even been thinking that. I'm still just curious what they were like young, what his personality was, how they met with my mother, and what drew him to her. And photos, of course, to see. Whether I'm the spitting image of Pancha. And I also want to meet my brother and sister. I still can't quite believe all of this is happening to me. That the inner voice that guided me, and one day, having heard the story of Olga Valieva, said, "Oh, Valieva found her father. You'll find yours too. Go. Search." That the voice was right. This is how this person inside me always worked. Sees that something is possible for another. Takes it as a benchmark for herself. We agreed to video call with Vladimir the next day. And so we talked. The search process turned out more exciting than the result. Already during the conversation, I felt disappointment and sadness. What is there to be disappointed about if there were no expectations to begin with? Turns out, deep in my little girl's heart, there were expectations after all. She wanted a miracle and a hero father. At least in something, she wants to be proud of him. Here's the story Vladimir told me. They went to school together, slept together a couple of times after doing time. They were both 22. Nothing serious, just knew each other since childhood. My grandmother initially insisted on an abortion because he'd just gotten out of prison. Like my mother, was on drugs and drinking. But the term was late. My mother was afraid to tell grandmother and hid it until the last moment. My grandmother forbade him from seeing me, and he complied. After me, he had another daughter from another woman, who kicked him out while still pregnant. He saw his daughter only a couple of times. Then her mother forbade it, like my grandmother. So he didn't try. Well, if they don't want to be family, then fine. What can I do? Then he had a son from yet another woman, who provided for him, got him drunk. It sounded like she was almost force-feeding him alcohol, but didn't want to move to his city. He left, abandoned them. Doesn't know his son either. 3 children. All 3 grew up without him. As if someone carefully copied the same script 3 times, and each time the father vanished. Didn't leave, dissolved. In all these stories, a common pattern. Others were to blame. The system in Kazakhstan, where they could lock you up for anything. Women who didn't want to. Grandmother who forbade. He's not a bad father, just unlucky. That's how he explained it to himself. And in that explanation, I heard not audacity, but a defense mechanism of a person who can't bear the truth about his own inaction. If everyone around is to blame, then he couldn't have changed anything. Then you can live on and not wake up from shame. He's 54 now, lived his entire life with his mother, in his mother's apartment, got himself a second group disability certificate, a government disability designation in post-Soviet countries, when he was still young and never worked. When I asked what his hobbies were, he said, "Nothing. Played drums when I was a real little boy." That's his whole story. I wanted to learn about my mother. He says, "She got tough after prison." He told me that my mother was at some kind of zone where they sat all day, handcuffed for half a year at a time, and only lay down to sleep. Sounds like unreal horror. After that, it's hard not to become hardened. They communicated with each other a lot, actually. She came over periodically to spend the night. That's it. After this story, my anger at grandmother miraculously transformed into gratitude, because I understood what I became is truly the best possible outcome. Yes, I paid a high price for it, and only I know that price. Yes, I still want to understand the laws of the universe, why prices are different for different people, why destinies unfold the way they do. No, I don't judge Vladimir. I feel calm and indifference toward his fate. He told all of this during the conversation, but didn't ask a single question about me. Not one. He has my Skype, and he never showed the slightest interest in getting to know me. On International Women's Day, 2 months after our conversation, he sent me, "Daughter, happy holiday. You are my one good one. Anyway, I love you." I felt sarcasm. With a life like that, I'd also be happy to have a worthy daughter. But I'm angry. Strong indignation. He did nothing to earn this. Didn't show even a millimeter of interest in me. He can consider himself a father, but a daughter is not someone who called once. A daughter is someone you raise. And he didn't raise anyone. Shockingly, achieved nothing. Such a worthless life. And in my indignation, I hear my own engine. I'm running from this, running with all my might, because stopping means becoming like him. I want to find a way to respect him. I found respect and love for my mother when I became a mother myself, plus tons of therapy and work. I understood her choices, her problems, but I don't understand how to understand my father. I know I should respect him and be grateful for my life, but I can't yet. My story ends with completely unpredictable feelings. I was so afraid he was already dead or would reject me, but the ending turned out orthogonal to all my fears. He's alive. He didn't reject me. He's just nothing. He likes the idea of having a daughter, but he's not interested in a real daughter. And he is below my worst expectations of a person. It took me many years to find love and respect for my mother. I hope I'll find my way to my father, too. Because until I do, I'll keep running. And I'm tired of running. But I found my sister, whom he also abandoned. And we're friends. This story was worth it. Chapter: Chronic Divorce Plan. After every fight, I planned a divorce. Not abstractly, not someday. In detail. How I'd leave. Where I'd go. How I'd live alone with the child. How much money I'd need. Which documents. I thought it through with the same thoroughness I use for work plans at Kaspersky, for organizing the move to Canada, for solving every task in my life, precisely quickly on autopilot, after a scream, divorce plan, after several days of silence, divorce plan, after a contemptuous look, divorce plan. The thought was always the same. I don't need anyone. I'm better off alone. I'll take Arseny and leave. I don't need anyone. I'm better off alone. Since age 5. Since the porch they threw me out from. At 14, the boarding school. At 25, left Maxime. Now, every evening, next to a husband who turned his back. But I didn't leave. Not because I lacked resolve. I had resolve for 3 people. I didn't leave because there was nowhere to go. A foreign country, no job. No money of my own. Not a single person who'd say, move in with me, I'll help. A child who needs a father. I knew this better than anyone. I'd been missing a father my whole life. And I didn't want to repeat my mother. The one who abandoned. The one who chose the bottle over her daughter. I didn't want my son at 30 searching for me through detectives. Every morning I decided to stay one more day. Not out of love. Out of calculation. Run the options. Choose the least painful. Endure. There was one way out. Work. As soon as I came back from maternity leave. As soon as I found a job. As soon as I had my own money, my own income, my own independence, I'd leave. This wasn't a dream. It was a plan. As specific as the plan to move to Canada, as the plan with the visa, as every plan in my life. Cold. Precise. With a deadline. I became dependent on Vitya because of a small child and no job. It was the very trap I'd set for myself when I chose to leave with him instead of building my own life separately. The reckoning for a marriage of convenience, you used his visa, now you're tied to him by daily life, a child, geography, same cage, different bars. In childhood, the bars were called grandmother, orphanage, nowhere to go. Now I'm immigration, financial dependence, child. The desire to leave grew with every silence, every scream. But alongside it grew something else. If I leave, I'll end up alone with the same package. Insomnia. Depression. A child I don't know how to love. The problem isn't Vitya. The problem moves with me. And for now, a divorce plan in my head. A feeding schedule on the fridge. A glass of wine in the evening. And the hope that someday I'd go back to work and finally be able to leave. Chapter: The World Closed. Then I went back to work and started building a career, as usual. The plan I'd been incubating for years. Find a job, earn money, leave, was finally coming to life. I had a job. I had my own money. For the first time in years of maternity leave, years of depending on Vitya, years in a foreign country without language and friends, I was standing on my own feet again, and then the world closed, literally. Borders, courts, legal offices, everything. Paperwork that could have been done in a month stretched to a year. Divorce during a pandemic with a small child in a foreign country turned out to be impossible. Not legally impossible, but practically. Nowhere to go, no one to turn to, no infrastructure, no plan B. The door I'd been walking toward for 5 years and it slammed shut in my face. I stayed. Again, as I stayed every time. The whole world was sitting at home. Running was an option for no one, not just me. But others were sitting at home with family. And I was sitting at home with a man I was planning to leave, with a child who screamed, and with a bottle that was getting closer. With COVID, the drinking got worse. Not because things got worse than they were worse before, but because the last exit disappeared. Before there was a plan, go back to work, leave. Now even that plan was blocked. The hope that kept me afloat, that someday I'd earn enough and leave, was zeroed out. And without hope, all that remained was what was. Four walls, screaming, silence, contempt, insomnia, and a bottle on the kitchen counter. Worked 12 hours a day, then came home, poured wine, and closed my eyes. Not to sleep, but to stop seeing my life, even for a while. Chapter First. Couple Therapy. We went to couple therapy. The therapist asked simple questions. Didn't dig deep, didn't analyze traumas, and just asked, what do you want from the relationship? What's important to you? What are your love languages? And as we answered, me, then him, I heard what I'd known for a long time but never said aloud. We have different love languages, completely. We have no shared interests. None. The romantic relationship never satisfied me, while he was always satisfied. He has no request beyond being a companion. He'll always be this way. And when I heard all of this, myself, my own answers spoken aloud with a witness, I understood. I'd entered the relationship on unfavorable terms, then spent 12 years trying to stretch something decent over my own foolishness. I was never offered romance. Why did I suddenly start wanting it? And then in one of the sessions, I told him about the divorce. Not about plans, about the fact that I'd been planning for years, that every day, after every fight, after every silence, after every contemptuous look, I mentally left, that I'd lived with one foot out the door the entire time in Toronto. Vitya listened. For the first time in all those years, I said the truth aloud, not in a journal, not in my head, not in a letter I'd then reread 20 times, but to him, to his face. With a therapist who wouldn't let us look away. And then the therapist asked something about the wedding. Or I mentioned it, I don't remember. And Vitya learned for the first time that a proposal had been important to me, that I'd wanted him to get on one knee, that there should have been a ring, that there should have been the words, be my wife, not for a visa, not for a stamp, but for me, that a ZAGS in a neighboring city before a work meeting, with a fake certificate and no dress, was not my version of a wedding. It was a deal, and I wanted to be chosen. He didn't know. 8 years, and he didn't know. Because I didn't say. I didn't ask for a proposal, just as I didn't ask for help during childbirth. Didn't ask for tenderness. Didn't ask to be chosen. Just as I didn't ask my mother to come back. Stayed silent. Endured. Hoped he'd figure it out on his own. That he'd see, that he'd understand without words, the way I understood my grandmother without words from age 6. I could read people, but I couldn't tell them what I needed. And there he sat across from me in therapy saying, I didn't know. I didn't know that mattered to you. You never said. And in his voice there was not an excuse. There was genuine surprise, as if for 8 years he'd been living with one woman and was now seeing a different one for the first time. The one who wanted to be not useful, but desired. Not a function, but a bride. Not a strategic visa partner, but a woman a man chooses and says so out loud. Chapter Finally. Some time later, after couple therapy, after he first learned that a proposal mattered to me, Vitya made one, in a tower, CN Tower, Toronto, height, a view, good food. He didn't get on one knee. There was no touching speech and no secret photo session that takes your breath away. It was simple. Something like marry me, without flourishes, without ritual, without what I had seen in movies, in books, in other people's stories, in the world where people propose, not because they have to, but because they can't not. Everything was backward for us. First, a marriage of convenience, zags in a neighboring city. Then OT, a child. Then our 8 years of official marriage at that point, and only then, a proposal. As if someone shuffled the slides in life's presentation, and the title slide ended up at the end, when everyone's already leaving. I stood in that tower and understood I should be happy, that this was what I wanted, what I'd waited for silently for so many years, and finally named aloud in therapy. A proposal, a choice, words spoken out loud, not implied. I should have been crying from happiness, or at least smiling, or at least feeling something. I felt nothing. Stood in the tower with a view of the city and waited for something inside to respond. No. More like, too late. The train arrived, but I'd gotten so cold I couldn't stand up and bored. The joy had gone stale. Vitya proposed because he learned it mattered to me, not because he couldn't live without me, not because he woke one morning and realized, this woman is my life, but because the therapist asked, I answered honestly, and he heard. He did it like a task, like an item on a checklist. Vera wants a proposal arrow, make a proposal. The same way he did everything, logically, sequentially, without extra emotion, without that inner, I can't not, which turns a formality into an event. And I said, yes, because saying no to someone who finally did what you'd complained about is like rejecting a gift from a child who drew it all night. Crooked, clumsy, not what you wanted, but he tried, and you take it and say thank you and hang it on the fridge and don't cry, because crying means admitting the drawing isn't right, and admitting that means destroying the only good thing he managed to give. We became a real family. That's how it looked from outside. A ring, a proposal, a tower. You can tell friends, write it in a journal, believe it. And inside lived a girl who dreamed that someone would choose her, not by therapeutic recommendation, but just because. Because she is who she is. Vitya chose me, in the tower. Without the knee, without the flourishes. 8 years after the zags, through everything we'd been through, the screams, the silences, Valyeva's skirts, wine for sex, divorce plans every evening. He chose, in his way, as he knew how. Not the way I wanted, but he chose. I learned a few more years later that back in Novosibirsk, he had decided he wanted to try with me, that he had chosen me then, just silently. Chapter short. Honeymoon month. After the proposal, we lived in harmony for 3 weeks. 3 weeks, I counted. Not because I wanted to, but because the body counted automatically, like a countdown. Because somewhere inside, I knew it would end. That good things don't last. That after every clearing comes darkness. New. And still allowed myself to feel. Briefly. Carefully. Like a person who was once burned, and now holds their hand near the fire but doesn't put it in the flame. For 3 weeks, Vitya didn't scream, didn't look at me with contempt, didn't go silent for days, talked, was present, not physically. He was always there physically, but truly present, as if the proposal shifted something in him, and for the first time in years he remembered there was a woman beside him. And I bloomed. In 3 weeks, like a desert after rain, instantly hungrily, without looking back. It turned out I needed so little. Not diamonds, not travel, not grand gestures. Just not to be screamed at. To be looked at without contempt. To be asked in the morning how I slept. To not have to drink at night to endure lying beside him, because there was tenderness. I took this for happiness. I started dreaming. This is it. Finally, he's changed. We'll be together. A real family. As I promised Arseny in that letter, in my 6th month of pregnancy, a complete family, loving parents, without mistakes, without aggression. The phoenix bird inside me spread its wings again. I thought, now, for sure. Now it's different. Now, for real. And then the 3 weeks passed and it started. His usual familiar, nauseating in its familiarity, screaming. Not about anything specific, it just returned, like a chronic illness that went into remission and came back out. The same kind, with bulging eyes. The contemptuous look that freezes everything inside. The displeased mug. Exactly a mug, not a face. Because a face implies expression, and he had one. You're in my way. Silence. Again. As if someone pulled the plug on 3 weeks of humanity and plugged back into the old mode, and everything went back to the way it was. I wasn't surprised. Inside, I always expected good things to end, that after 3 weeks of peace would come the reckoning. That happiness always has a price. Someone will suffer. Something will happen. It's always been that way. The childhood formula worked without fail. 3 weeks of good means bad is coming, and it did. Self-fulfilling prophecy? Not worse than before. Just the same. As if those 3 weeks had been imagined. Later, I would understand something unpleasant. That I didn't just wait for the good to end. I helped it end. Not deliberately, not consciously, but a body that had lived for 40 years in the mode of you'll pay for happiness doesn't know how to simply accept good things. It starts checking. Is this really good? Will they deceive me? When will the blow come? And this checking, the tension, the expectation of a blow, scanning the face for signs of danger, itself creates what you fear. You expect to scream and clench up. He sees you clenched and gets irritated. He gets irritated. And you think, see, I knew it. The prophecy fulfills itself. Not because it was true, but because the body never gave a chance to learn that things can be different. Chapter California. March 2021. We moved to America, again to a country with no friends and no family. 15 years I dreamed of living in California. We moved thanks to Vitya, palm trees, the ocean, sun. Arseny was 5. Vitya had a job. He transferred with an Amazon. I thought, now we'll move and I'll definitely leave him. As soon as I go back to work, as soon as I get on my feet, as soon as I have my own money, my own contract, my own independence. This plan lived inside me like a life raft, like the only reason not to drown. It gave meaning. Endure now, because later will be different. Later, in America, real life would begin. In the 1st week, I went outside barefoot, just because. The asphalt was warm. The palms rustled. The air smelled of something sweet and unfamiliar. For a second, I thought, maybe here it will work. Not to live differently, just to live. The second passed, but the body remembered it. But until later arrived, I had to survive until then, and I chose the strategy that seemed the only one possible. Don't provoke, don't anger, don't upset, don't give a reason. Become invisible, silent, perfect, so he wouldn't start again. Like when we first moved to Toronto and he was the sole provider. I walked on eggshells around Vitya, literally. Cooked what he liked, said what he wanted to hear, didn't argue, didn't object, didn't show irritation, didn't show exhaustion, didn't show anything that might trigger that look. The contemptuous one and the scream with bulging eyes that makes the blood run cold. Everything I did was subordinated to one thing. Just don't let him start screaming again, like in Toronto. I avoided aggression. My whole life I'd avoided it. This wasn't a new strategy. It was the only one I knew. With grandmother, read her by the sound of footsteps. If heavy, today would be bad. Need to be quieter. With Maxime, stay silent, endure, don't talk about money. Now with Vitya, Walk on eggshells so he won't scream. In 12 years of marriage, I showed him my anger 4 times. 4. In 12 years. Once, threw a coffee mug at the wall. Second, smashed dishes in his vase. Actually didn't smash it. The floor tile cracked, the vase survived. Third, threw his old tablet into the bathtub when he refused to keep a promise. Fourth, said, fuck you. The fourth time happened after we'd already separated. After 12 years. After therapy. 4 times in 12 years. And I remember each down to the details because each was a catastrophe for me. Not for him. For me. Because showing anger meant losing control. And losing control meant becoming grandmother. Becoming the person who screams, hits, frightens. Becoming what I'd hated since age 5 and feared more than death. California. 15 years of dreams. And I walked on tiptoes. Same fear. Same sentry inside. Fear. The feeling that no one needs you. The feeling that you're in the way. The feeling that if you disappeared, it would be quieter and everyone would be better off. How can this be the same cage? It can. Because the cage wasn't on the outside. It was inside. And I brought it with me through Kazakhstan, Siberia, Novosibirsk, Toronto, San Diego, through all my escapes, through all my moves, through all my it will be different there. The cage traveled with me, because the cage was me. Back then this sounded like a sentence, now like a beginning. If the cage is inside, the key is too. Later I would understand something unpleasant, that I didn't just wait for the good to end. I helped it end. The same part that couldn't relax, couldn't be happy without anxiety, couldn't believe that good can simply last. She started destroying. Not consciously, not maliciously. Simply, the body couldn't hold good for longer than 3 weeks, and started looking for what's wrong, and found it, always found it. This is a pattern. I'd later see it in ACA clearly, with a name. The child who grew up in chaos can't tolerate stability. Stability feels like the calm before the storm, and when the storm doesn't come on its own, the child creates it, not to suffer, to finally exhale, because the weight is harder than the blow.